Can we perceive the EU and its law in utopian terms? As a project that is committed to a profound and positive transformation of the terms and conditions of a common European life? This is a question that deeply divides opinion. And this division reflects a deeper uncertainty and disagreement over the dominant meaning of European integration and of the nature of the EU as a polity. Welcome to the third episode of Integration Through Pod. I am Franka Feisel. I'm a PhD researcher in law here at the European University Institute and a member of our EU Law Working Group. And I recently had the privilege to talk about all these questions with Professor Neil Walker. For Neil, the notion of EU-topia is much more than just a nice wordplay. During a Leverhulme Trust major research fellowship on the topic of law, community, and utopia, he has spent a lot of time over the past years investigating what one might call the EU's existential questions through a utopian lens. And it is hard to think of someone better suited for doing so. Neil Walker holds the chair of Regius Professor of Public Law and of the Law of Nature and Nations at the University of Edinburgh and is one of the leading constitutional theorists of the EU. Be it around questions of sovereignty, constitutional pluralism, or now law and utopia, what makes Neil's work unique is the way he navigates the conceptual richness of legal theory and of the history of ideas to shed light on the constitutional questions of EU integration. And having worked with Neil as a research assistant back in Edinburgh, let me tell you, it is even more enlightening when you talk to him about his work in person. So that's what we did. Let's hear what he has to say.
Va d'abord rendre un arrêt dans l'affaire C-345 de 95, République française contre Parlement européen. La Cour déclare et arrête, premièrement.
It's great to have you here, Neil, in your former academic home. Welcome, and thanks for agreeing to talk a bit about your new project today.
Thank you, Frank. It's great to be here. I was a professor here between 2000 and 2008, you know, the important times for the EUI, but also for the European Union. And it's really nice to reconnect with you back in my other spiritual home and in your new spiritual home in Firenze, in Fiesole.
That's right, and we never run out of stuff to talk about. So today I would like to talk to you about your major research project over the last years, where you looked at law and amongst other case studies, I guess one can say, at the European Union through a very interesting prism, that's that of utopia, right? Now, that might not exactly be intuitive for many people working on the EU and EU law, which both have this image of being very technical or technocratic. So at first sight, there's not much utopian about competition law or comitology, one might say, right? So would you like to give us a bit of the background story for why you chose to look at the EU and at EU law in this particular light of the idea of utopia? Why does it help us to better understand the nature of the EU?
Okay, so you're probably correct, Franca, that it's not very intuitive, but I like to start with the counterintuitive, because sometimes that's where you get the best insights. So I think maybe I'll say something by way of background about the project more generally, because it might help contextualize my approach to the EU. I think utopia is one of these notions which is under-researched, under-analysed. One of the reasons being that I think in today's world, we tend to use utopia in a kind of dismissive way. We use it as a pejorative term, or that's just utopian. We use it either as a way of describing things which are just a daydream, or we use it as describing things which start with good intentions but end up in bad authoritarian places like Soviet-style communism, etc., etc. So basically, utopia gets bad publicity, but the original understanding of it coming from Thomas More and the eponymous book of 1516, but also more generally, is that utopia, precisely, it's at the It's at the edges of our understanding of what is possible. It's not about impossibility, it's about saying, how can we both be realistic but idealistic and have strong aspirations in the world? And it's interesting that some of the most famous writers of modern law and modern politics, they do use the term utopia. They talk about realistic utopias like Roberto Unger does, or utopian realism with John Rawls. So these are people who are trying to find that sweet spot between something which is very, very idealistic, but without being impossible. And it's no coincidence that all of our utopias that we think about are realistic utopias, even the ones which have ended up being dystopian, have been in the modern age. Whether it be nationalist, or whether it be communist, whether it be national socialist, or whatever else that they might be, or liberal. All sorts of different sorts of utopia. So, for the most part, utopia focuses upon the state. Why the EU, which was a question, I've taken a long-winded way around to actually even begin to answer your question. So maybe let's start with the scepticism about it. Why would people be sceptical about the EU as a utopian project? One would be, they would say, well, okay, didn't the EU actually start off as a corrective to utopian projects? You know, the EU, or let's call it supranational Europe, because it didn't become the EU until the 1990s, but the early European communities, their point of departure was recovery in the post-war context. So what's that recovery from? It's a recovery from the dystopia of National Socialism, but it's also a recovery from, or at least a sharp alternative to, what was seen as state communism, right? So how could that be in itself utopian? And the people who are sceptical would carry on and they would say, okay, you know, there's something about the EU which is actually, you know, as opposed to being utopian, it's actually either a very conservative project, it's about trying to retain and consolidate what was good within the nation state. It's also one which focuses very, very much on the individual, albeit with an emphasis upon economic rights, and not until a later generation, broader rights. And the emphasis upon individual rights for many people is seen as something which is against the utopian impulse, which is to have very, very broad, imposed collective solutions. And also, to the extent that the EU is seen as being progressive, many people would say that its message of progress was always a very, very incremental one. You think of the language of neo-functionalism, etc., etc. The language of the Schuman Declaration, Europe shall be made step by step, etc. So there's an awful lot in there that suggests that utopianism isn't the way ahead for the EU. So I've just realised now I've talked myself into a corner and say, why would we nevertheless talk about the EU in utopian terms? So one answer is precisely because of this, right? The EU inhabits a world, you know, which is a world of, you might say, utopian disillusionment, right? So you can't make sense of the EU other than somehow as a response to something which itself only makes sense in utopian terms. That isn't as paradoxical as it sounds, because many forms of modern utopia, we think in areas such as climate change, etc., etc., often responds to things which are seen as being extremely bad. You know, utopia often emerges from a context of strife, struggle, disappointment, fear, etc., etc. So the very fact that we're coming out of a maybe failed utopian moment doesn't necessarily mean that the solutions themselves don't have a utopian dimension. But more specifically, I would say maybe three areas where it's important to think about the EU in utopian terms, or three dimensions. Often utopias have either an input or an output dimension. They're either about how we remake the we of a particular community, or they're about what we will do, what are the specific objectives associated with that particular political community. And what's, I think, interesting about the EU is that it does both, right? There's a sense in which there's something which is radically innovative at both levels. Now, that's most obviously true of the remaking of the we in post-national terms. can we think of a community which thinks itself as a political community in a post-national context? What are the things that stops that happening? How does it hit up against existing national communities otherwise? What are the possible benefits? What's the utopian horizon of doing this? Peace, prosperity, whatever else it may be. It's very, very important to look at these sorts of things. And just because we're used to the European experiment doesn't mean that we shouldn't lose sight of its radicalness, that remaking of the who. But we also remake the what, because the EU doesn't have a generic role in terms of the specification of its public goods in the same way as a state does. What you have is an ongoing battle throughout the history of the EU between projects which may be quite sharply different in their substantive objectives, between maybe a more kind of the stark utopia, to use Carlo Polanyi's term, of a more market-driven, market fundamentalism against more kind of social democratic utopias. So at the output level as well, there's something significant. Very quickly, two other ways in which the utopian idea is important and special to the EU. One is that alongside what I've said, at the kind of sociological or even phenomenological level, many of the people who have driven the European project, have, in a sense, thought in utopian terms. Joseph Weiler has famously talked about the messianic element of the European project, the fact that the Schuman, Monnet and various others of the founding fathers, unfortunately, very few founding mothers, or the founding mothers lose their place in history, as is often the case. Basically, the idea that these people saw themselves as on a mission, right? On a mission to achieve something which was both salvationist after the war, but something very, very specific. Peace and prosperity, remaking Europe as a place free of conflict. And many people over the years have said that that attitude continues. Obviously, this messianic dimension is important, but then the third dimension, I think, has to do with the relationship between, let's call it the particular and the general. One of the tensions that we find within utopia, as well as the tension between input and output utopias, another tension is between utopias always start off in a particular place or about a particular community, right? That's people's always the first interest is in the particularity of that community. The second idea, though, is more general. It's very, very difficult to say, I believe the world would be an indubitably better place if it was organised like this, but only here, right? It's very hard to say that and then leave it at that. So there's always a tension between the particularity of a utopia and its generality. The wish to spread it, the wish to use it as a kind of template for it elsewhere, and that's always been the case in the EU. When people think about the EU in utopian terms, to the extent that they do, I think a lot of people's initial sense would be, yeah, that's maybe how the EU projects itself to the world. It's not even so much about its internal operation, it's about its kind of, what Calypso Nicolaides called, the kind of narrative of projection. We are the peaceful continent, we are the continent which does things by deliberative means. We are not just good in ourselves, but we are an example to the world. So there's that kind of outward-looking utopian dimension as well.
Right, and that's quite interesting, isn't it, in the sense that that is maybe not necessarily a feature or characteristic of utopia. If I look at Thomas More's utopia, that was not necessarily an outward-looking one, right? It had its trading partners, but basically left them be, although, of course, the utopians thought themselves superior in their way of doing, in their way of being organized, but reduced their foreign relations, let's say, to a very pragmatic modes of engagement, right? So that's quite an interesting contrast to the EU, isn't it?
That's a good point. Although what I would say is that utopias tend to find it very, very difficult to resist the impulse to spread themselves. Even Thomas More's utopia part of what he was arguing there, because he had this idea of a ideal semi-rural community which started off as a peninsula but becomes an island, but there was a kind of formulaic aspect to it, you know, that if you want a utopia, here's the formula. And there was a sense in which it would not be correct for that utopia to have imperial ambitions, because that would be anti-utopian. But it wouldn't be a bad thing for others to understand that this was how we would make an ideal community. And the fact that you actually had, you know, a model for it, you know, in a sense is already an invitation, right, for repeating, you know, repetition. There's something in that spirit which says, you know, this is how things should be organised, and therefore they should be organised elsewhere. But as you say, it very, very much stands against that sense of, you know, superiority, you know. So there's a real tension there, and I think you can see it in the EU as well.
That's very interesting. Now, I want to pick up on another dimension of the EU's utopia, or the EU in relation to utopia that you mentioned, and that's the collective rethinking of the we in post-national terms. Now, if I read your work correctly, I hope I'm not putting words into your mouth, you seem to see the potential, if not even the need, for a proper constitution for the EU, or perhaps even more a constitution-making process, right? Something that is able to build a reflexive sense of self for the EU polity. Now, the advent of such a process has arguably become a bit less utopian recently, one could argue, if we equate the possibility of treaty revision with constitution making here. And one reason for that is arguably itself somewhat utopian and in character, you could say, and that's the Conference on the Future of Europe, as that's the first kind of transnational, multilingual, participatory democracy, right? And several of the substantive and most discussed recommendations of the conference plenary, they require treaty change, and they have spurred a discussion around treaty change. Of course, the overall echo from EU institutions and national capitals is still somewhat mixed, but I think you see a reluctant opening to at least the possibility, discussing the idea and the possibility of treaty change. Now, my question here is twofold. Are we at a stage where the EU needs a big C constitution? And if so, what role do you see for participatory democracy, like in the form of a citizens' assembly, in such a constitution-making process?
Just a small, straightforward question. Yeah, I mean, it's obviously, this is quite central to, you know, a lot of things I've been thinking about. And you can't talk about utopia without recognising that most utopian projects don't necessarily end in failure, but they end in a kind of diminuendo, or they end in some sort of kind of frustration. And the point about the EU is that it carries on, and you think, you know, if you get beyond the original limited messianic aims, you know, what do you do next? You know, are you caught with a polity which has a kind of strong technocratic top-down bias, because it was once so sure of its objectives, but now it has much more open objectives, and it has to rethink both the who in terms of these open objectives and also the what of what these objectives should be. And that's why I think there's so much interest in generative politics as well as programme politics. I think there has to be. And I like that distinction, because if you call them generative politics, they don't necessarily have to take a big C constitutional form. But we do know that they're kind of second-order politics. They're politics about how we do politics, rather than politics about what the programmes actually are. Do we need to worry about these second-order questions? The answer is, yes, we do, because, you know, we might disagree about these programmes. There might be issues about the output legitimacy associated with them. We might also be stuck in a situation where we can't deliver these programmes, you know, because there isn't enough consensus, etc., etc. So the second order questions, I think, are inevitable. And I think they are questions of the who, which, as I said, is part of the initial really quite distinctive utopian dimension of what the EU is. So, how do we do that? Right. Now, you're right that I think it's very important that we have, you know, some sense of to borrow a phrase, a kind of democratic minimum in the context mm-hmm. Of the EU, a sense of the people of the EU self-reflexively understanding themselves as the people of the EU with a distinctive, not exclusive, but a distinctive European public good, able to think about it, able to engage with each other, all inhabiting that same space, that same role space as European citizens or European subjects, thinking about it in these terms. And we've never had that. We've never had that baptism, right?
Right.
In that sense. So the point I would make is that why go to the Constitution? Why go to law? Well, without going into all the complicated reasons why I think law is so central to the EU, and I think it is very central to the EU, part of my argument is that beyond all of the moral, cultural, pragmatic, positivist virtues of law, law normally within a state context also has some more fundamental constitutive virtues, right? In terms of the making of the political community in a more fundamental way, usually through some kind of constitutional means. And the dilemma, that maybe it's a kind of trilemma in the EU context, is how do you deal with that, right? Do you imagine that, on the one hand, here, option number one, that there's a kind of natural homologation going on, that everyone has come to realise that there's some sort of European public interest and all we need to do is get the reform process moving again, get another IGC, etc., etc., and maybe the Conference in the Future of Europe can help that because it puts in these, what, the 49 substantive suggestions, you know, to the institutions, saying, go ahead with it, see if you can actually make this run. Arguably, there's a practical problem there, but there's also a normative problem because the EU continues to be an entity where the states are the masters of the treaties, and the states initially see themselves at least very much as groups of national citizens. So the idea that we're seeing ourselves as a European citizenry is something that we struggle to argue, we struggle to impose. So I think there are difficulties there, both practical and normative. The other two suggestions are that we go whole hog towards a more fundamental constitutional solution. We actually have something which is like the convention process under Article 48, but which goes a stage further, which maybe has the discontinuity that is usually involved in constitution making, where the constitution is no longer the legacy of the international law process. It's something which cuts itself free and says this is about the European people. And of course, people like Jürgen Habermas, Markus Parkberg have said it would be cutting itself free in a very special way. It would be a kind of dual constituent power. We wouldn't be giving up on the European peoples, but we'd be saying that part of the pouvoir constituent mixed would be the European people. So it would be a mixture of the pan-European citizenry on the one hand and the member states and their national citizens on the other. And this would get to what would be distinctive about the EU polity. This would get us to that kind of democratic minimum. This would be what would have the catalyst effect. That's probably closest to my ideal, I have to say. But there's those who are more critical of that and who say, again, you've got practical problems. How do you start this process? To which one answer is you start it because we're in crisis, that we continually now see common predicaments, whether it be on Ukraine, whether it be on migration, whether it be on the euro, whether it be on fundamental rights, whether it be on the Brexit situation, which just because of the expanding jurisdiction of the EU become far more by way of common crisis than we thought before, that might be the catalyst for this. In other words, it may well be, just as the original constitution failed because people said the time was not ripe, well, the time could hardly be riper now than it is. But I understand the argument that it's very, very difficult to do that. I also understand the argument that it may be seen too much as a provocation, a kind of way of bringing in Euro-federalism by the back door. I don't think it necessarily is. In fact, I strongly think it necessarily isn't. Mm-hmm. But that's a hard argument to make. You could have a common European people without these people thinking themselves in federal terms. But I also think that others just have a different sense of the relationship between democracy and constituent power. So I would say that many of the people who bought into the idea of the conference in the future of Europe as being an experiment in democratic generation rather than polity generation said, look, what we have to do is we have to look at all the different pinch points in the European public space and try to stimulate them and to generate far more by way of a democratic conversation. Let's have citizens' panels. Let's then engage with the idea of citizens' panels as something we can do in the future, which has already been done after, you know, in the second generation of citizens' panels. That way, we build up Europe, you know, but as a kind of, not through this, you know, this iron constitutional form, but much more as a kind of formless generation of democratic energy. Now, I think probably the best answer requires a bit of both, and both of these things happening in conjunction with each other, you know, rather than as being mutually exclusive. So I don't agree with these people who either think that the conference in the future of Europe invented a paradigm which is the only way ahead, nor do I think it was some kind of disastrous miss of an opportunity or something which was only good at the cosmetic level. I think it has its own contribution to make, but I also think the remaking of this notion of constituent power has a contribution as well.
I see what you mean, and I think that's a very good and nuanced argument, in fact. But I think that also the conference on the future of Europe, there's a lot of untapped potential in this form of transnational participatory democracy with regard to the democratic energy that it can bring, and that is how the process is framed, what subjects are submitted to it, because it's not been so far, it's been maybe more of a policy than a polity generative process, because the questions that were put to the citizens were mostly of a substantive nature and less self-reflexive. And of course, I think this is a process which can have more of a polity generative function as well. But I think precisely when it comes also to this idea of a European public good, this is something that you don't get towards by choosing the topic of food waste for a citizens panel, because that precisely does not touch upon the deeper underlying moral divisive questions that need to be answered to create this collective post-national identity, because it's a deeply uncontroversial question, right? It's not food waste, yes or no. But then it goes into the technical polity details, and that's maybe not where citizens' assemblies can make the biggest contribution and fill the democratic lacuna and provide the democratic minimum that is lacking at the European level, right? Do you think a European Citizens' Assembly would be suitable for the broader constitutional questions? Could you imagine that? A constitution-making Citizens' Assembly?
Yes. Yeah, it's a good point, and it's a good critique of mini public assemblies as well. So one of the reasons you might criticise some of the citizens' assemblies we've had is, first of all, that it's quite narrow what they're talking about. But secondly, you know, often they're talking about the kind of operating within a safe space of something which is already part of the EU's, it's within the EU's gaze, you know, and the whole point of this is to kind of expand the gaze.
Yes.
So, yeah. So I think, you know, apart from the fact that it's quite narrow and quite derivative and within a kind of safe space, I think there's a more general issue. If we return to my distinction between generative and programme politics. So people have, including political theorists, but, you know, others have a very different understandings of what the relationship between these two ideas are. And you might say that if you believe in the general constitutional project, you actually have quite a strong division between the two, that you've got to do the polity generative stuff somehow independently of the programme stuff. There's lots of other people who don't really believe that. They think that, including a lot of agonistic theorists, etc., etc., they think, no, these two things are almost kind of fused, you know, and it's through doing programme politics that you rethink how you generate politics as well. And I can see a bit of that in the whole citizens panel thing, because on the one hand, you know, you get somewhere in programme terms, maybe not very far, but secondly, you know, you actually get this kind of experimental thing. And this goes way back to the, you know, the Charter of Fundamental Rights in 2000. You know, people say, oh, it has two purposes. You know, it introduces or reintroduces fundamental rights to the EU, but it also reintroduces this kind of new form of generative politics through the convention. That's how we got the convention and how it was built into the failed constitutional treaty and then into Article 48. So the two, you know, the two are not necessarily mutually exclusive, right? So part of my answer would be, it is no bad thing if many public type citizens' assemblies continue to do their work over these other things, because you can see it spreading like a seed, you know, across different ways.
I like that picture.
Yeah. Of you know, having different examples of the symbiosis of program and generative politics, right? I think you're asking a slightly different question. Can you see that also as a model for the broader generative process? Yeah, I think it would have to be, if you're doing a pouvoir constitutional mixed, there would have to be some of the other stuff in there as well. There would have to be the institutions, they would have to be represented too, but there would certainly have to be a much fuller representations of the citizens' assembly too. And it may well be what you would need would be some kind of complicated composite body, mm-hmm. a bit like what you had within the Conference on the Future of Europe, where it's not just about the plenary always meeting, it's about ways in which different groups can retain the integrity and the autonomy of their thought and fill that into the system. Because the danger is that if you don't do it in that kind of mixed and joined up way, then you end up with, I think, one of the problems with the Conference on the Future of the Europe, which is they got to do all the kind of interesting polity generative thinking as well. But then, at the ultimate stage, it goes back to the already constituted powers of the EU, and they decide whether or not they're actually going to take any fundamental initiative in taking the law. And so far, it doesn't look all that likely. You know?
Doesn't look all that likely, no. So not utopian in a positive sense.
Not necessarily.
No. I would like to pick up also on a notion that you came up with in our previous discussions, and that really spoke to me, and that is that of precarious maturity, the EU having reached a state of precarious maturity, which arguably relates to perhaps the need of a constitution. But I think it's at the same time also just a very good diagnosis of where we are, of current developments in the EU. And I think this idea of precarious maturity holds in particular when it comes to the relationship of the EU with its founding values and the defense of such values. And this is something that I'm looking at myself in the context of my research on the EU and the concept of militant democracy. So a few months ago, for the first time, Article 2 TEU was invoked as a self-standing infringement ground in proceedings against Hungary. And now, a few weeks ago, the Commission for the first time relied on Article 10, the principle of democracy, in infringement proceedings against Poland. Now, I would say there's something in itself utopian, maybe, about the development of a transnational militant democracy, but that is not necessarily, or not straightforwardly, in a positive sense only, because the notion of transformation and radical change at the core of what characterizes also a utopia is just as much at the core of the principle of democracy. And then the enforcement of a specific let's say, judicial understanding of the principle of democracy in the EU's multi-level and pluralist polity could perhaps have the effect of undermining democracy on another level, right? By foreclosing or inhibiting precisely this transformative and radical but democratic change. So what is your take on the enforcement of EU values or even a European identity, perhaps? Utopia or dystopia?
I assume this is the last question because it's the hardest one.
That's why I left it for the end.
Yeah, I mean, it's, and also it's something you're working on very closely yourself. And yes, these latest developments, especially the Article 10 one, are very, very interesting. One of the ways in which we think about the democratic minimum, right, to go back to that term, you know, there's a sense in which the EU has been very, very much exposed as basically having to be almost like a laboratory for polity making, where the democracy question has to be resolved without a strong cultural basis or background. You know, when we think about militant democracy questions in the context of the state, etc., etc., we always do it against the background that there's an already existing state authority, there's an already existing constitutional form. It's a constitutional form which we hope, well, most of us hope, has moved in a kind of liberal direction. So by that we mean that it's a constitutional form which is truer to the broader value-related purpose of democracy. Democracy is there to maximise our collective agency, but also to maximise our collective agency in a way which does not impose unnecessary constraints upon our individual agency, because both the collective and individual agency are important, and democracy cannot be seen as a self-standing value. It has to be something which feeds into that. And states arrive at this more or less successfully, but they often do so on the context of a cultural substratum that already presupposes a sense of community, which is already there. So famously, Böckenförde in the German context said, the issue with the liberal state is that it cannot necessarily generate the preconditions of its own authority.
Right, yes.
You know, and of course he was making that point, you know, almost as a critique of the liberal state or a puzzle for a liberal state, but it's also a wonderful advantage of the liberal state. The liberal state somehow was bequeathed many of these cultural preconditions and got to be a liberal on the top of it. Okay, that then creates consequential problems when that kind of liberalism is challenged, etc., etc. But at least it had this moment, right? This moment where you have the cultural substratum and you have the liberal politics. The problem with the EU is it never had the cultural substratum, right? So basically, yes, it's trying to make the liberal democratic politics ab initio, out of fresh air, right? Now, so what you have then is a moment where the cultural making of Europe is simultaneous with the working out of what the meaning of the democratic minimum might actually be, right? So that's just a diagnosis, right? But right. I can see why in a situation like that, you know, that it's a kind of like the Böckenförde problem, but multiplied,
yes,
you know, because it's actually trying to resolve the question of liberal democracy in a context where democracy itself is still just a formative good in the EU context. And of course, clever illiberal politicians understand that. Right.
So we're seeing perhaps a precarious circularity
we're
there.
We're seeing the precarious circularity. Yeah. And I'm not sure what the utopian solution to that is, except, again, I think we have a diagnosis of something which is very, very, very particular to the EU. You know, it's getting to be a democratic seminar in real time. in a way that other polities don't necessarily do. And there are better and worse answers to that democratic seminar.
Right, and I guess we get to be at the forefront together with our listeners of this democratic seminar. So that's and all active participants in in this seminar, and this is going to be an exciting one. Well, Neil, thank you so much for this very stimulating conversation. As always, I'm sure our listeners will enjoy it a lot as well. And also, your book is coming out on the Law and Utopia project. When listeners to watch out for that?
The EU one will definitely be out next year. So that's been made a commitment. You heard it here first. Yeah, sometime it'll probably come out as one of the Academy books in the OUP series, but it'll be Law and Utopia in the EU context, but along with other utopian writings that I'm developing.
Okay. Great, so that's going to be the first one on the reading list for our real-life EU democracy seminar.
Let's hope.
All right, thank you so much, Neil.
Thank you, thanks.
And that was it for the third episode of Integration Through POT. This episode was recorded at Villa Salviati, home of the EUI's Law Department, and also of the historical archives of the European Union. The episodes are recorded at the Radio Cavolo Studio, the EUI researcher community's very own radio station. We'll share a link in the description so that you can check out some of Radio Cavolo's program. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned for the next episode of Integration Through POT.